something, by the way. I think you told MP, we are discussing this often, starting a discussion something on public hearings as part of a public participation model that's been led by the product, where we encourage a greater interactive process. I don't know how far that will go. It was taken some distance in 2004, and unfortunately it lapsed. So it's been revived as from today. So basically, what we're going to do this morning then is going to ask you to go through, Roy and your team, your draft. It's a draft science amendment bill. It's a table of all the amendments. Another amendment is the proposal that came and what your response is. And I think because, you know, not all of us are on the same page as it were. We are politicians. Some of us have got technical experience, some of us haven't. I think in fairness to all the members, if you could also take us through carefully, because of the significance of this bill, but also because of the nature of the relationship between the executive and parliament. You see, the executive's got all this technical stuff. And so the power balance is awkward. We have one president waiting on it. I mean, there's nobody else we've got. And on this thing, PBO is helping us either because of their job. So, and we've got Advocate Jenkins. So, you know, we don't want to pass a bill that we don't understand fully what we are doing. So you're going to help us by doing this. Okay. Thank you very much. Over to you, my friend. You can go to page 3 immediately.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair. I'm going to ask Rukhile and MP to present because they've been, Rukhile has had the unenviable task of actually reading every single submission. As you've seen, Chair, there are many pages. I think we're up to 200 pages of submission.
On the poverty rate, we had about 12,000 pages. And guess what? This will go down Guinness Book of Records. I think I read about 70% of it. If you want to know why you would value the root of a tree and not the apples, in 2004 I could tell you. If you want to know why you would, oh man, it was a bizarre thing. We spent 320 hours on that book.
Wow.
That's in formal meetings and about 100 plus hours where, as the chair would sit with other MPs, I would meet, you know, everybody. Everybody said if we pass the bill, the skies would fall down. Right? Mm. A tradition leader came here and quoted Foster. Said we're too ghastly to contemplate this one. So, you know, everyone is paying property rent. So this is not a big deal. I think the TRC has more.
Wow.
The 200 pages, with due respect. I mean, really, that's sounds crazy. I'm cheating you. You did a very good job. I'm actually so happy.
Not being formally approved by
page, and it starts with looking at Tier 2 committee.
Yes.
The one.
So now,
the top of prevention.
Yeah, sorry, apologies.
It's the later one.
Yeah.
You gave us yesterday morning.
Yes.
Now that's the official document we're dealing with.
Yes.
So can we deal with that one, please, so to avoid confusion?
Okay. Would you like us to start with Tier 2?
No, you can do whatever you want, as long as we are working from the same document.
Yeah.
Colleagues, we are looking at the document here.
Yeah.
It's got on the top in red, draft.
Yeah, I think, just to highlight, obviously what's happened is a submission came in very late, so we'll try to include it.
No, no, I understand all of that.
Worthwhile.
You can start with credentials provided you fill out page number.
We can start with Tier 2. No, it's not. We'll come back to Tier 2 at the end.
All right, so let's go to credential. It's on page, colleagues. Ah, there it is, on page 19. We're on page 19 now. Is that right?
Yes.
Right, good. That's where we're starting, right?
So, their major concern was that the bill provided for virtually unfettered discretion for the minister in relation to how he may dispose of assets and liabilities. And just sort of our response to that was that we feel that the PAJA provides enough oversight and enough limitations on the exercise of this power by the minister, and that all actions that he will undertake obviously must be reasonable and consistent with that law and the constitution. It was a general concern that was highlighted by a lot of the contributors. The next one, which is future growth. Future growth was broadly supportive of the bill as it stands, with the exception of wanting to include Section 155 of the Companies Act, which allows for a coordination mechanism between creditors to come up with a compromise. National Treasury considered this proposal and included it in the latest draft of the bill, which is now before you. So Jay, Investec Asset Management provided various submissions. So the Tier 2 submission, which is the late one that you've received, ostensibly is the same party. I will go through the original submission now and then later the last submission. So their submission originally covered a wide range of issues, including concerns about the retrospective changes of property rights and how this will hurt pensioners and the economy at large. They were also concerned about the predetermined instruments being subordinated, contractually subordinated, and that really essentially means that the old style Tier 2 debt has much greater protection than the new style Tier 2 debt. That's the assertion. Their other concern was that curatorship is not equivalent to liquidation. An additional concern was that results in losses of pensioners, high interest rates, and lower foreign direct investment in the economy. That's a broader macro concern. So on the first issue, the retrospective changes to property rights will hurt pensioners. As mentioned yesterday, we've had legal counsel's views on this issue, senior counsel's views on this issue, and it is our belief that retrospective changes to property rights in civil cases is not a constitutional issue. As far as the Tier 2 debt not being
me, how do you want to do this? I'm a bit worried. We're going to go through 65 pages, and it'll be over in half an hour, and then you're going to come back to each of these issues, or do we want to deal with them as they come up? Does anybody have any ideas how you want to do this? Can members please help? I mean, I don't know how, I don't know the mood of the meeting, where people are at, and then, you know, I'm just going to rule to do it, yeah.
Jason, I think we should deal with them as they come up. I mean, certainly from our side is that we have had a lot of discussion between us yesterday as to our position, so it's becoming quite clear to us where we are going with the thing. So, you know, and we've also read through the documentation as well. We are aware of what people said. We've seen the responses, etc. So we really don't have to beat the thing to death. There are a couple of issues that we have, but we will raise them at the appropriate time. Thank you, Chair.
Right, so what do you think? How do we process this document? Right, so in other words, after each input from a stakeholder, then who else members do you have anything to say? I think that might be... Yeah, I know, you see. The way I had requested it to be done is different, as you recall. I said, choose a theme, and then say, these are the six organizations that said the same thing. That's how we did all the bills until 2009. We didn't have it like this. But now you ask it, and it doesn't happen, and then guys have... I mean, you've spent hours on this thing. And I said, well, I give up. You know, what do I do? It's a long document, and this is not how we asked for it, because it's exactly what I feared. You see, the way we've done it with all the bills that I've been responsible for as a chair, anyway, is we say, people say the minister has got too many powers, okay? Then we'll put under there the arguments of prudential investor concern. Then we look at that issue. Then the next issue is, hey, it's retrospectivity. How many organizations said that's a problem? What did they say was a problem with retrospectivity? We deal with that. That's what I asked for, clearly. But when I got this thing, I also, when I started reading it on Monday night, I thought, this is not what we asked for. But hey, what do we do? So in future, Cindy, can you just do it the way you asked to do it? It takes us a lot of time. This is not a productive, even logical way to do it. It's like a shopping list way. Let's look at each. The word shopping list is exactly what we should avoid in committee. We told you, all of us are clear, we're looking at shopping list now. Shopping list is used in each one, it's going to overlap. So I think what you might, since you have such a good command of the issues, you might want to say, on retrospectivity, these were the issues raised, discuss that. On the issue of ministers' powers and curators' powers, these are the issues. So, on the issue of the consequences of passing this act, oh, you know, the sky's going to fall down sort of stuff. Why do you think the sky won't fall down? I think that's the way. Can you manage that? Maybe it's asking too much.
Chair, I think he has prepared that document actually really internally, and we actually have it here. So we could take you through. We've done it that way also, which we can take.
Yeah, we prefer that, wouldn't we?
If you're okay.
So we're dealing with themes, and it's faster, and it's more organized.
If you're okay with following on the board in terms of the big themes that came up, because what we did is exactly what you said, right? We went through all of those matrices, and then we prepared...
Yeah, something that will interest you for what it's worth, right? Because there seems to be quite a sea change where Parliament is now. What we used to do previously, you see, if you had like 400 submissions, you would say people feel the powers of local government are being taken away. Now, if it sounds like it's saying that, you actually gave it more weight than it's Mr. William Smith who said it, because it's one individual. That individual has a right to make representations to Parliament. And we allow those individuals to come here. We said, Mr. Smith, do you want to come to Parliament? Especially if you're based in Cape Town. Make your presentation. But obviously, Selga represents in those days, how many, 283 municipalities. So it carried more weight than Mr. Smith. Or it could be Mr. Kumalo or Mr. Knight, who make no difference. It's something like I'm focusing on Smith. Right? If Mr. Kumalo or Mr. Knight, who was a single individual right there, they carried some weight, we looked at it. But not as much as Samu or Salga or Imatu or something. So similarly, here I have these people all have the same weight, so to speak, in the sense that there's two categories of people, right? Okay, having said that, I just want to draw the committee's attention, and I think National Treasury and whoever else is relevant to the following, right? What we are doing here, let's be clear, is we are seeking clarity on the issues raised. We are seeking to get a firmer technical grasp of the issues. We're seeking to understand the implications of the proposals you got on how we deal with the African bank and related challenges, right? There is no party political position here. So when members speak, they are really, like, this is called the informal phase of a vote, right? It's when you enter the formal phase that parties come with political positions and say, this is how we feel as a party. The GA seems to have already arrived at its decision, but I can assure you that the majority party is not ready by any means. So when members raise questions or offer views, they are tentative. It's like a, it's like a brainstorming session. You can't say, oh, so-and-so said this from the ANC, therefore that's an ANC position. So members should be feel free to say things like, you know, I want some clarity on this. It seems to me, you know, my tentative view is it's fine. Because there's no, like, there'll be a collective position the ANC will take. And that'll be later down the road. So what I'm saying is members can feel free to pose whatever questions they want, but also to make contributions to enhance the quality of our understanding of the issues. It's only when we come back in the next quarter that we will begin to come with some positions. The value of this process also for us, I mean, we're not like the DA, they seem to be clear about that. We're saying that the value of this process is also identifying for us maybe the 5 or 6 major policy issues on which the majority party has to take a decision. If we don't explore that with you now in this open session, it makes it more difficult for us to itemize what are the 6 or 7 policy issues on which we need to retreat to a study group and say now, these are the 7 issues, what is our position in terms of the ANC's policies on, you know, on these matters, if there are guidelines for that. You understand? So as long as you understand, and the DA also understands, and anybody else, whoever might be relevant, PMG and so on, that this is really the informal processing of the bill, we need to understand a lot more before we come to policy positions. Okay, thank you very much. Does anybody want to say anything about the process now? We're moving towards thematic issues, and you tell us who said, and on the process issues, we're saying, for those of you who came late, oh, we don't repeat, okay, fine, carry on.
Thanks, yeah, I'll ask you to take us through, I think, vaccine rather than about that.
I'm not sure if it's been covered already, but I thought that the committee might need more substantiation on this fact. It was raised by entire two committee. The issues around agency and timing, because when I read this, I was also a bit cautious because it appears to be very reactive. And you know, we don't know what's going to be happening in future, and we don't want to end up taking a decision that is going to be locking us in a situation that, in a peculiar circumstance that happened now, and only to find that in future we are sitting with a problem. But I'm not sure if it's already been covered, but I know that it was the first theme that was coming up very strongly, and I saw that the senior councillors were did comment on it. And they actually were also linking it with the powers that are given to the curator. And I'm not sure if those powers that we are giving to the curator are informed by what is currently happening now, or they are well thought through. Because even National Treasury, in certain instances, you are saying you can't, where there are others, I think it's Investec Asset Management where they commented as well, where you are saying they have not substantiated, so you don't have, you can't, you, it does, the, what their comments do not contain the data that you can verify. But to me, that is not enough. We have to find that data so that whatever decision that we take, at least we know that what we are taking is well thought through. We have thought through all the issues. We are all not only thinking about now, but we are also thinking about the future. And so that it's not a short-termist view that we are taking on this view. I'm not sure, Chair, if it's been covered, but if it has been, I'm sorry. I just thought that it was a matter that I read through and I was a little uncomfortable and probably needed more elaboration on it and more persuasion on it, because it just didn't gel well with me. It National Treasury's own addition, they have not done sufficient work to verify what other commentators are saying, you know, people who have something to say on this. And they are saying they can't express their view, and I was a little concerned about that.
Now look, you see the point, because I think it's very valid. It's related to something that has been asked, but now that she sees, this is valuable, because what's happening is we won't be able to get clarity unless members engage more actively. And it helps me to chair a bit easier once I know what the themes are. And I must tell you quite frankly, at this stage, you know, I hear you and you sound very convincing. Then I'm sitting in the house and I read something in between all the fracas that's taking place there these days, and the new thoughts occur to me and I wonder now, hey, you know. So I think this is very good. See, what Makosi is asking is presumably somewhere there, except it as a theme. It's related to another question we asked when you first came here, which is, what is the relationship between this bill and your Twin Peaks bill, as it were?
Yeah.
Right? In other words, we understand your Twin Peaks bill will be more comprehensive. So what will happen to this? In other words, what Makosi is saying is, in its own merits, enormously helpful, I think, right? But in addition to that, the implication of what's that, I think that's what she's saying in another way, is what's the relationship then? And I think she's right. We need more clarity about the relationship between the Banks Amendment bill you have before us and the financial sector, call it the Twin Peaks bill you're bringing later down the road, right? Okay. So I think it's a very good set of questions, Makosi. I don't know why you've been so apologetic. It's very good.
I think I fully agree with you and what Comrade Makosi is saying. Because one of the things, as they go through the things and even explaining what the amendments to the bill have to say, we should be able to, like you were saying, whether see a marriage between this and what the Twin Peaks will be doing on other things. Because even from yesterday, my thinking was our amendment is more informed about the African bank situation. Are we reacting to it, like you were saying, or we are doing things in broader terms to cover even future incidences going forward? So I'm just saying, as they deal with the things and going through the themes and explaining some of the things, it will also be important and very assisting to some of us just to see whether, as we deal with some of the things, some will even talk to the separation which the Twin Peaks is now coming to on Prudential and all other things, see if they also speak to some of those things.
That's also helpful. It strikes me once again that I think, right, I'm just saying this, I'm not saying that, you know, it's a way of encouraging a discussion, but we're not having an endless academic discussion. We want a discussion towards being clear about what the practical issues are. Now, I don't know if we all accept, but most of us will accept that the African Bank and its current challenges require amendments to the bank's bill. What we're saying is that let's do what is necessary to get the African bank challenges addressed, right? And let's not lock ourselves in for a dispensation for the financial sector as a whole, as Makosi I think he is saying, beyond what we need to do to address the African bank challenges, right? So we hear what Momo says, which is, he says, separate the issue of the African bank from the other issues, and you'll see it's not such a controversial bill. We think that's fine, but it's not helpful, as somebody said yesterday. So what we're trying to say is that, yes, there's a need for a bill. I think this is what we say, right? Not everybody's going to agree. We think there's a need for a bill, but let us address purely the needs in our amendments of this bill around the African bank thing. And let's not actually lock ourselves in for the whole banking sector now on issues that we could address in the second phase, if you like, the FA, the Twin Peaks bill. Am I being clear, Sol? I don't think I'm being exactly clear. But I think if you put what Vicky and Makosi said, and I've been two verbals, I'm not sure why I'm not so clear this morning as I'd like to be, but do you understand what I'm saying? Good. Okay. That's helpful. Yes?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm certainly hoping we're not going to confuse ourselves, because my understanding from MoMo yesterday was that, you know, there is some discussion regarding whether this came about because of African Bank and therefore, you know, that's a problem. The fact of the matter is it did come about because of African Bank, but I don't think we can just look at a bill to say, well, how does this affect the African Bank? Because it applies to everybody. You know, so tomorrow, heaven forbid, something happens to another bank, the same, obviously, legislation would apply. So we're not able to ring-fence it like that. But I do agree with you that the big problem on the table is, in fact, African Bank, and we need to make sure that something happens. So we're completely in agreement on that. But I also agree with you that we must maybe keep it as tight and short as possible. You know, so I think we're kind of in the same place. Thank you, Chief.
Because he's prompted us by actually saying that, you know, that's exactly what Makosi is saying. And it's very helpful. Really, it is. Did you want to say something?
If you look at the object of the Sanchez Amendment, it's very clear that everything is triggered, was triggered by the development in the African market. Also, issues of the global standard compliance are coming into play into this amendment, because the intervention was mainly to manage the contagion, you know. So it's, we don't have a broader problem. So that simply says, I mean, it can only be relegated to one institution. So I think the approach that both Makosi and Honorable George are citing, maybe Honorable Makosi and Honorable George are citing, to me, is exactly what should continue to be the focus of this committee. Yeah.
Well, I think to manage this thing, what we do is you go through the themes and then come back to this primary theme at the end. Because what will happen is, as you look at specific issues, it will also give us greater clarity about where the bill should begin and end, so to speak. Bearing in mind that Twin Peaks bill is looming, right?
So, Chair, I think it's a very good point. It's an issue that's been bothering us quite a lot, so we will definitely come back to it at the end. I think now we'll just go through the themes and then we can have a discussion. Identified by the contributors was the issue of creditor protection. Their assertion is that the proposed amendments to the bill will result in extensive discretion being granted to the curator and to the minister. The ability of the curator to transfer liabilities of the bank, this will impact on creditors' rights, which we agree with. The contemplated amendments limit creditors' rights with limited participation by creditors in this process. Creditors therefore generally sought provisions which ensure creditor approval
as a requirement prior to any transfer of liabilities. National Treasury's views, initial views, are that to approve disposal of assets and liabilities to allow creditors approval in the disposal of assets and liabilities would essentially amount to a private sector veto over public interests. So that was our guiding principle, and that's why we were slightly nervous and came up with ways to have a sort of middle ground. And we feel that middle ground is the current framework as allowed by PAJA. So in all of the different proposals around this issue, we cite PAJA and the Constitution as adequate protection for creditors' rights and a reasonable way to balance competing interests of private creditors and public interests. So that's sort of the first issue. I don't know if you want to go into more detail from a principal's perspective or... Okay.
So they don't accept that argument of yours even now, right?
Chet, there is some differences amongst the contributors. Generally, they seek greater protection than that's currently offered by PAJA and the Constitution, which is something that we don't necessarily agree with at this point.
As we understand your main point, it is that the public interest ultimately has to take precedence over private interest in this specific set of circumstances, right? Mm-hmm.
So this perhaps goes to what you were saying slightly earlier. We believe that in instances in resolutions and in bank stress, which could have potentially catastrophic and broader implications in society, that public interests should not be elevated above private interests. That was our guiding principle, and this is a principle which is consistent with international best practice, as cited in the FSB's key attributes.
Just by noting these things, I explained earlier that the senior counsel was not available from the second tier. It's a question we need to ask, Bridget. Are you noting this? They're talking about public interest taking precedence of a private interest, but secondly, they're saying the FSB says that should happen. It's an international financial governance issue. So why should South Africa be an exception? Well, you note that question. So when they come here, you know, members will raise it. If they forget, you will. Then you will raise it because you meant to facilitate our exchange. Sorry, Makosi.
I do agree with National Treasury when they say, the Constitution and PAJA takes precedence. However, where I would love them to probably substantiate a bit is whether there is a process, a pre-outlined process that the curator will follow in disposing those assets, because the fear that might be there from the creditors might be justified in a way if you think that, you know, the curator might actually probably resort to dispose those assets in a way that may be detrimental to the ultimate value that they will derive out of those assets. I'm just saying, is there a way that balances that out so that at least, even as we say the Constitution takes precedence, the Constitution always needs to be, you know, checked up by something, you know.
And the Constitution that should be sufficient guarantees as to protection. Is there any other legal aspect, and perhaps the question is related to Advocate Jenkins, that we can strengthen this if there's a concern that this is not enough protection in some sense? Any other legal proposals, perhaps?
Thank you, Honourable Member.
are two parts to answer that question. The first is that the bill itself has some process contemplated, the first being the preparation of a report. That report, we anticipate, will have to be made public because PAJA will apply to any action and decision of the curator. Once the curator has determined what is the best alternative available to rescue African Bank, the curator will prepare a report setting out the impact of that decision on all relevant stakeholders. That report goes to the minister. The minister then calls for comment, and having considered comment, will make a decision. Section 54 of the Banks Act, which is already in the Banks Act, does not permit the transfer of assets of a bank outside the ordinary course of business, except with the consent of the minister, if it's a large transaction, or the registrar, if it's a smaller transaction. And the public official who makes that decision has to consider the public interest before making that call. So that's the background of what's already in the bill. From the curator's perspective, the input would be each bank crisis is going to be different. And so to hardwire a inflexible process may well be appropriate in African banks, if we all understand what the issues are now. But if you hardwire that process beyond what is already in the Act, it may well not work on the next bank failure. And to the extent that creditors believe this doesn't give them adequate comfort, the view we as legal advisors to the curator have taken is that what PAJA requires is two things. It requires both procedural fairness as well as substantive fairness. And the advice we've given to the curator so far, given the African Bank situation, is that PAJA will require him to put together a full dossier of information. And once, assuming that he has the power to do the transaction which the Governor of the Reserve Bank announced last year, and that will only happen if this bill is passed, he will put together a full information briefing, which will be made public. An appropriate amount of time will be made for all stakeholders to give input. At the moment, it's anticipated that that would be in the region of 4 weeks. And only after having received that input will the curator be in a position in terms of PAJA to make a decision. So it's important to highlight at this stage that what the Reserve Bank announced is not the absolute final means for the rescue of the bank, but it's the only option that is considered currently on the table to be viable. But what we anticipate is through the PAJA process, people receiving information will then be in a position on an informed basis to suggest alternatives. And if any alternative is clearly better for creditors, for the public at large, for employees, then PAJA will constrain the curator to consider that better approach and implement that. And all where we are at the moment is simply that this bill will allow more options for a curator to decide how to save the bank. So a good bank scenario is what this bill will allow, but it's not committed to a good bank outcome. It means that if a better proposal is made to save the bank than the current entity, notwithstanding that we've now added an additional ability to the curator, if that is the best deal, that is the deal that will have to be implemented. I'm not sure if that answers the question, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for the response. Time is of essence when this process is undertaken, mainly because the key objective is to avoid permission of such things into the sector. Now, what I wanted to check, how do you factor that in? Because I hear you saying something like 4 weeks, but I don't know, maybe it's because of my limited understanding around the sector, but what happens in a situation whereby we need to act now? If we don't act now, I mean, obviously there might be some unfortunate repercussions. How do you factor in this issue of timing to make sure that the process remains fair, as you have alluded to?
Thanks, Chair, and honourable members, colleagues. Chair, when looking at the issues, it looks like creditor protection does come up quite significantly, and when I look at Section 25 of the Constitution, for example, I was trying to make sense of the constitutionality issue, although I am limited in terms of my legal understanding. But it looks like the public interest in this case does take precedence. But I think that perhaps maybe it would be beneficial for the committee, if possible, to have some access to the contracts that were signed, because I think the only way to know how exactly this would impact on the issue of constitutionality is to look at the different contracts that were signed, because some of the creditors enjoyed greater protection and some didn't. And, you know, I hear the Treasury referring to, like, narrow clauses in the contract that they're not worried about, but I think that if Parliament itself were to look at these contracts with the, maybe if the research unit could work with legal services, we have 4 weeks to look at the Treasury documents. Maybe if we could have access to the contracts if possible. I don't know if Treasury has already looked at, like, all the contracts and sort of, like, they probably have a better idea of what the different contracts entail and what the issues that could emanate, what the constitutional issues or the probable possible constitutional issues are. But I think that maybe Parliament could also look at the contract and sort of link everything together before the committee comes up with a final decision after constituency period. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response to the first question, Honourable Member, it's a very good question, because it's something we've applied our minds to quite considerably in the last number of months. That four-week period is not set in stone. What the curator has to consider is how much information needs to be processed by the interested public, what is the complexity of that information, and what is the urgency required in order to deliver a resolution. And it's balancing the complexity of the information, needing to allow stakeholders to understand and give informed comment, but also to then implement a transaction before it's too late for the relevant bank. And that period of time will therefore be different in each matter. If the bank is absolutely on the brink of collapse, has no liquidity whatsoever, then waiting 4 weeks may well not be reasonable in the circumstances. In other circumstances, perhaps 6 weeks is more appropriate because of complexity and because of not quite the same amount of urgency. And that's the flexibility that I was speaking to earlier, that because each bank failure is different and the amount of information and the complexities will be different, hardwiring a particular period or particular process might work, because we are all thinking of African bank now, but we may well regret not preserving the current level of flexibility on the next bank failure. And that flexibility, in our view, does not impact negatively on creditor rights. Because if the period of engagement determined by the decision maker is inadequate, if it is unreasonable, well, then any stakeholder has the ability to challenge it in terms of the Promotion of Access to Justice Act. And I can tell you the curator is acutely aware of the scrutiny he'll be under in terms of departure, and is acutely aware that the period of time and the level of engagement is fundamental to getting any deal done, because he doesn't, and none of us would need this transaction to be derailed because of an inappropriate decision leading to months and years in court. To the extent I've answered that question, the other question, most of that documentation, I think, is public, and we would be more than happy to gather the public documentation and to share it with the research team, particularly the notes, the trading notes, but those terms are very much public. There will be certain bilateral agreements which are subject to confidentiality, and we wouldn't be in a position simply to override that confidentiality. The only caveat, and I think it would be absolutely very helpful if the research team could look at the agreements. The only thing to bear in mind, and it goes back to the point that the chair was raising at the beginning, and that is, if we get too tied up into the detail of those contracts and apply those contracts to the wording of the Banks Act, we're getting further to making something that is purely an African bank response rather than something that we believe helps in the African bank relationship,
but will need to stand on its own once African Bank has been rescued, and potentially the curatorship provisions of the Bank Act have to be applied against the next bank failure.
In summarizing it like this, so that we don't like have circular issue arguments. On this theme, at this stage, in this very informal phase, so that people don't misunderstand, our tentative view is, a majority at least, is that the case National Treasury makes overall is reasonable. That the public interest, climate transfer, private one, that you're using FSB international guidelines, that, you know, this is part of international financial governance. There's nothing exceptional about it in this country. That people have access to power. That the curator will be foolhardy to make decisions that will end up with torturously long court challenges. So at this stage, unless we hear, which is why it's good if they had them going, oh, you know, let them tell us what they want to say. I can't see what they're going to offer, frankly, David, that's going to be so overwhelmingly strong. I mean, what would they be able to do? They can bring the senior counsel. So that's why it's a pity, you know, we could have just heard them and got it over with. But now we've agreed to hear them, and we'll have to find a slot. But we're not going to open the discussion out. What we're going to do is just hear them. In a nutshell, these are the points, this is where we've come to. So is that a reasonable summary? Bridget, you're making notes, I take it, together with the secretary. I think Estella, you're doing it. Because we're not now, I'm going to rule people out of order if we start the whole process again. Because we'll spend 5 years here with this bill. So you're making notes, presumably. We'll give it to Bridget. She'll organize it succinctly, pithily. You know, these are the things we covered and so on. So do members want to add to that summary? Is that a reasonably accurate summary? Good. Now, do you want to add anything to your argument?
Just a brief note, Chair. You would have seen the letter from the senior creditors that was submitted yesterday. They control probably, as I said yesterday, the bulk, absolutely the bulk of the funding. And they are here to I don't think we should put them on the spot to say, but they are here to agree that, you know, that they feel that this is sufficient. So.
That would be me. I think all that we really wanted to say was that we recognise this process cannot be done perfectly first time round. We're not going to come up with the perfect set of banking resolution legislation in one go in an emergency. We believe this is a reasonably pragmatic middle ground between trying to expedite the African bank scenario and setting some of the key principles that need to be in place longer term. So while it's not perfect from our perspective, on balance, we can support this as an interim piece of legislation.
Next thing, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. The next major issue that was brought up by the contributors was the question of the valuation of transferred assets. Many of the contributors wanted a fair market value for the transferred assets. National Treasury, in principle, agrees with this. Our concern was, as Peter alluded to earlier, hard-coding ways and mechanisms in determining what the value of those assets should be. And the complexity around doing that is twofold. The first one is time. When an incident happens and there's very little time in sort of determining what the true or what a fair market value for assets would be, perhaps the argument is a little bit circular because the longer you wait in, so you can have a value for particular assets, those assets in that time can deteriorate in value. So it's both better to act very quickly in determining the value of those assets so and allow the curator or the resolution authority to act in an efficient way, but allowing for too much flexibility or in itself would allow, would result in the assets deteriorating over time. The second issue is normal market conditions. To determine the value of assets that are complex and often market or security instruments requires normal market conditions, and in a crisis, that very element is absent. So pragmatically, and to not unnecessarily constrain a curator or resolution authority, the Treasury is of the view, or is tentatively of the view, that the only constraint on the resolution authority or curator is to act reasonably and in good faith. And insofar as that, we would point again to PAJA.
On this one? Yeah, Michael.
I honestly think this one is really reasonable. The fact that you have a curatorship measure suggests that there is already a crisis. And really the market can't, as much as you would love to get the market related value, the challenge is you are dealing with a crisis, and you may actually be under pressure to dispose of those assets as quickly as possible. And I think it's reasonable, Chair. From my point of view, I don't know what the members.
Anybody else? Okay, can we ask you something? Play devil's advocate. Try and save us time. Because you don't have endless discussion, Chair. Things are beginning to get clearer today as against yesterday. You know, at least in my mind, so to speak. What problem they have with your reply? You met them on Monday, right? You must have told them these things. So what did they say in reply?
My understanding, Chair, from them, there's been a lot of discussion with them, is that they're actually okay with this clause. Their big issue is the no creditor left worse off clause. Is the no creditor left worse off clause? They feel that it may constrain their rights. We're actually going to get to it now in this section. It says that it may adversely affect them.
We're saying at this stage, right, short of hearing the other side of the argument, we think that this valuation of transfer assets, right, that what you have in the bill is fine because they want the market value for transfer, right? And you're saying, yeah, in principle, but how do you value in circumstances like this? A, it's time. This thing is so quick and so on. B, there's an absence of normal market conditions, right? So how do you determine it? So the curator will have to apply his or her mind and be fair and reasonable. And those who are unhappy, well, they can refer to PAJA and any other legislation. But David raised a question, Advocate Jenkins, for you. I just recall now. He didn't reply. It is, apart from PAJA, what other legislation would they have recourse to should they be agreed? The second tier.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the situation in South Africa is that we don't have administrative tribunals like Australia has, which deals with these kind of administrative reviews of decisions taken by officials in government that got the delegated power in legislation. The only problem there is that you have to go through normal court procedures. Sometimes it may take long, it might be expensive, but it's not always long and it's not always expensive. It depends on the facts of the matter. But in South Africa, it's a very strong mechanism to fight. Because what I hear in Honourable Ross's question is, yes, we have a review process with the minister and the registrar, but it's still that side of the line. It's still the executive deciding. So there's a review process, which is also subject to administrative review, but we want an independent review of the decisions made there, and I think that's what the creditors would also like to see. In that regard, PAJA is what they have in South Africa. Until we come to a point where we think that administrative tribunals might work better. But PAJA is a very, very strong mechanism, Chair. I don't want to belabor the point, but the ground set up in PAJA is very broadly stated. Some of them are so broadly stated that they were open to some criticism by former judges of the Constitutional Court. But it goes to basically anything that's unconstitutional, if one wants to throw that out there. To say that you didn't apply your mind, the decision is so devoid from relying on the facts that there's, so anything can be reviewed. Some commentators have even said the granting fire amounts to an appeal ground as well. It goes to the merits, not just to the procedure that was adopted. So my personal view is fire is very strong. It's strong enough, but that is what there is. There's nothing else, as far as I'm aware.
So I think this is a typical case which we will have to ensure that it gets escalated when we consider the Twin Peaks legislation. Because when we deal with the market conduct and those type of issues, these are the things that we'll have to make sure that they are in place. Because I know that with pension funds, you have a range of them outside just Paja. You have a lot of systems of structures that you can appeal to if you are not happy, even with the whatever the returns that you got out of your pension fund and so forth. And I'm sure that going forward, because the banking sector has been a bit blurred when it comes to that area, when it comes to the market conduct issue, it's been blurred, and probably this is one issue that we can kind of elevate when we consider the 20th legislation. Sure.
Just a remark in terms of this emergency legislation that this process here. But on the creditor protection, my view is that there's excessive powers to the minister, and then but that we've dealt on. The second point now, with regard to the value of determining the asset value of that's going to be transferable, I think this is where the curator comes in, and I think also I just get the sense that this is the point I'd like to make. I just get the sense that there's too much hours for the curator in terms of determining this the value. Would you like to comment on that? I just get that sense.
It also relates to that. To the extent you can rely on FSB guidelines or what's happening elsewhere in the world, would the curator's powers in South Africa be inordinately greater?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, we have taken advice from international restructuring firms, both auditing and legal, and the very clear advice is that what we are asking for and what we're supporting in the current bill is not at all out of kilter with international best practice. As Honourable Van Rooyen mentioned at the beginning, banks are different creatures, and banks in crisis are different to other types of business in crisis. So I certainly am sensitive to the criticism of the scope of the powers of the curator. And in another industry, I would probably respectfully agree. However, when dealing with such systemically important institutions, the more tape one ties up a curator in, the less likely there is to be a speedy resolution and a speedy restitution of the status quo. And so, as advisors to the curator, we would ask that the honourable members consider the administrative justice provisions that will apply, and recognise that because each situation will be different, we are, I think, almost certain to put a set of rules that might work in one case but not in another. If we go for an inflexible set of rules to apply. I'm not sure if that adequately answers the question, but that's the current position.
What I hear over the years I've been around here, and what I see in the newspapers, and even some independent experts, both PIA and PAJA are regarded actually as very advanced by global standards. Would I not be correct? It's probably, it's highly respected legislation. Whether it's implemented properly and the quality of the legal represent, that's another issue, right? But as far as those two acts go, well, I think we are global front runners, isn't that correct?
No, they're not perfect, but you are right, Sir Chairperson. Especially the access to information. Access to information needs a little bit more work. There's some criticism from the courts on the timelines for noting an appeal, which is a procedural thing which can be condoned. Nevertheless, in the court resolution in there, for the problem. But you are 100% correct, Chair. They're not seen as a backward.
Just one quick point, Chair. On the other difference between banks and other industries is obviously there's quite a lot of money at stake. These are very sophisticated players. They at the drop of a hat will instruct senior counsel to use all these mechanisms which are available to them. These are not unsophisticated.
Should we move on? Next major issue which was raised by the subordinated group of creditors is the issue of equal treatment of pari passu claims. In their view, curatorship is not a liquidation process. It is the equal treatment of claims that rank similarly. So, Chair, in their view, liquidation, the curatorship process is not the same as liquidation, and therefore, since we are not in liquidation, their claims should not be subordinated vis-a-vis the claims of other classes of creditors, namely senior creditors. Our view, or our guiding principle, was that creditors bought subordinated instruments which resulted in a higher yield commensurate to the higher risk they were taking. And for us, intuitively, doesn't make sense that once the entity runs into trouble, you would simultaneously, having received a disproportionately higher return, be afforded greater protection under public action, particularly when they may be social or public interest considerations.
Okay, on this one. Can I ask you again, what do they say when you say that? What's their reply?
Yes, sir. This has been, I guess this is probably the bulk of their argument, which is that they maintain that curation is not a liquidation process. And that goes directly, I think, to the heart of their concerns, which is that they say that in curatorship, they are not subordinated. They rank the same in a pari passu with the senior creditors. They have obtained legal advice, which is in their quite long legal opinion. I can read the summary, that, maybe we should let them speak to this directly. Yeah, but just so that I can at least say that we have done them justice, so that we're not, they say that we say it's different, but I have no view, we have had our own legal advice that this is not correct, and they say that it is arguable that the proposal is irrational, and provides for arbitrary differentiation and authorizes arbitrary deprivation of property. This would be the position where the minister approves the transfer after forming the opinion that unequal treatment of creditors is reasonably likely to promote the maintenance of a stable banking system sector or public confidence in the banking sector, and when such an opinion is at variance with the facts but is not vitiated by reviewable irregularity. The mere possibility that such a decision may be made at some time in the future may conceivably undermine public confidence in the banking sector and the stability of the banking sector to the extent that the proposal is not rationally connected to its stated purpose. My understanding is that they're arguing that, and I think that was the point in the creator's answer, essentially what they're arguing is that the minister may, or he might, make a decision which might subordinate them. It's important to differentiate that the minister has not yet made this decision. We are only providing the mechanism for the minister to make this decision. They are arguing, they say that it might well be that the minister may make a decision to subordinate them in the future, and that is what they think, that decision might be unconstitutional. If I can summarize our senior counsel, he says, yes, indeed, the minister might make an unconstitutional decision, but the minister would most likely be advised not to make such a decision, and if he did make such a decision, they could certainly take the minister to the Constitutional Court.
Would it not be correct that that would apply to anything?
Absolutely.
Any bill can be challenged on the grounds that the minister concerned might act unconstitutional, but that's why he's the Constitutional Court. That surely can't be the sense of the argument.
I would suggest you ask them. I don't want to
say anything else. I mean, I'm sure they got something more than that. The fact that a minister might do something illegal, not even unconstitutional, means that we cannot pass any law there. Any bill that comes here, you can raise that. So I'm sure they got something more. But we'll ask them. Well, you know, when they turn up here, we can't wait endlessly. We've got to slot it in some way quickly and get it done. All right. In that case, my question
is, we are at the same. In the same time, the Treasury is, we are second respondent, but the Reserve Bank's first respondent. We are in front of the Constitutional Court on this issue. It is on Shuttleworth, actually. People have the right to take us to the Constitutional Court, and they do. And we will defend, and they will put forward their arguments, and that is how the system works. There is a promotion of Mr. Justice Act.
You know about the Shuttleworth case, it's in the media.
So
when is that case coming up? Do you know?
No, it's really come up. The decision, I think, is still a few months away. My point that I'm trying to make is that, yes, the minister may make a decision, but that decision is fully reviewable. It is fully challengeable. We are prepared. We would be very hesitant to make a decision that is unconstitutional, because we know they'll take us to court.
Do you want to give
us
a
So what that means is I think the Latin is it is of equal value, roughly. So what they're saying is that in their view, their subordinated debt is of equal value to the debt, to the senior debt.
And
the
of course, you recall is, well, you were getting more yield, more return. You were taking a risk, right, as against your senior creditors, right? And it's a risk you take. It's a market offer. It's really interesting how those who fully support the market, unconditionally, right, almost, when the market acts against them, right, they complain. But they have a big say in shaping the rules of the free market, and then when the free market doesn't benefit them, they cry about it. But when they benefit from it, it's huge yields. Makoti?
No, Chair, just a simple question. I just wanted to know, how does the legislation, any legislation that we have, define or make a distinction between the curatorship process and the liquidation process? Because I think that that's where the problem lies in this instance, because to me, both processes can lead to a similar outcome because they are motivated by the same whatever. But I don't know how in the legislation these two are distinguished. Probably the lawyers here might actually assist us so that we can see the thin line there, you know, because we may overlook this and yet we may not be able to explain it at the end of the day if we use our simple English. Maybe we need the legal English, you know, to help us understand the distinction between the two.
I think I also help ask the curators' lawyers to help because they have come to learn the Banks Act in the most extraordinary detail. They've read every single case relating to it because they are currently assisting the curator. But essentially there are two processes. There's a Section 68 process, which is liquidation, and there's a Section 69 process, which is the curatorship process. So they are distinguished in the law. We have never contended necessarily. We have no, we Venezuela, we have no view on whether they are or are not subordinated. And for that reason, we have not accepted a request from the senior creditors to insert that into the law. We don't think it's appropriate that the law makes that decision. We believe that that decision should be made by a court because it is very complex. And we would think that that should go on review after the bill is passed if they still have a problem. But I can ask you as lawyers also to give some flavor to that.
Thank you, Jay. As Mr. Hoverman said, the two processes are both in the Banks Act, and fundamentally they are within the power of the registrar. So when a bank is in distress, the registrar of banks makes a decision to intervene, and having made a decision to intervene, he will either decide to place the bank into curatorship or proceed to liquidation. Liquidation is the end of everything. And liquidation, the same rules as in any other company would apply. And the liquidator in the liquidation has only one real aim, and that is to realize the best value for the creditors. Very limited. But because we're dealing with a bank, curatorship has been introduced. And in curatorship, the registrar will consider the public interest. And if he thinks there's a public interest issue and the bank is in serious trouble, he will rather than go straight to liquidation appoint a curator. And what's different there is the curator doesn't only look to maximize the value of the creditors of the bank. His obligations are to attempt to rescue the bank and in all things to make sure he acts in the interests of employees, of creditors, of the financial system, and in the public interest. So he has a wider brief than a liquidator who's simply realizing value for creditors. It is possible, though, that the two processes end in the same place, but that depends on the facts before a curator. A liquidator has to wind up the company. A curator attempts to rescue it, whether in the entity or if the spill passes, by creating a new entity that can survive. And he can also realize value by selling assets. But all of those things he has to do in the interest of a much wider public, which a liquidator doesn't need to do that.
There are creditors that maintain that curatorship is not a liquidation process. And therefore, on the basis of that, they are therefore expecting a different outcome. And that is why, to me, it becomes absolutely important that we are clear in terms of what exactly, in terms of the outcome, are the two processes likely to produce from the perspective of the creditor, because both of them are contained with the creditor at the end of the day, and except that the other one obviously even includes the wider public interest and so forth. But I thought that it's going to be important for us not to just overlook this, because to me, I think we may actually find ourselves, if we overlook it, you know, those little finer details, sometimes they matter in the final analysis.
I agree with that, and I think the QH was that. My understanding is that at the moment, if the bank is liquidated, the subordinate debtors will get nothing. If the bank is retained in curatorship, the subordinators may get something, depending on how well the curator does his job. I think that there's a fair assessment of roughly. In liquidation, I guess everybody loses because we're liquidating. Curatorship, we're trying to keep the thing alive, so there might be some value for subordinate creditors. Which is why the test is, why the test we've introduced is that no creditor must be left worse off than they would have been in liquidation. They must get more than liquidation. Because this is a curatorship process. Otherwise, what's the point of we should have liquidated?
Thank you. I fully agree with that point. In fact, it's the bill that introduces the no creditor worse off provision. And the way we understand it is simply because when a bank's in trouble, there appear to be only two options, curatorship or liquidation. And there doesn't appear to be any reason to go into curatorship if it's not going to produce a better result than liquidation would. But there is a public interest override in the current drafting of the bill, so that even if some creditors would be worse off, because curatorship is about a much wider set of stakeholders than liquidation, and you're considering not only creditors, you're considering the entire banking industry, employee, pensioners, everybody, that if the minister decides that notwithstanding that creditors would be worse off, the public and the banking system would be better, he can still take a decision to continue with the curatorship. However, in our opinion, that would only happen in truly extraordinary circumstances.
The ANC study group, right? Because I think they're going to finish in the next 20 minutes or so. So, Kiswa, so you'll stick around. So, Kiswa? Alright, somebody just tell Kiswa, I think it's Kiswa. But you'll stick around, you can have a little study group. Because I think we're going to finish shortly. I can't see much value in continuing beyond your last point here. Okay, so then we're dealing with retrospectivity, is it?
Thank you, Jeff. The final major issue before we perhaps deal with one of the honourable members' questions about the timing and urgency question that she had in the beginning. This issue was constitutionality or retrospecificity is an issue raised by the subordinated Tier 2 creditors who believe that because the amendments will apply or may be applied in the case of African Bank, that the law is retrospective in its application, and that the fact of this retrospective application is unconstitutional and would therefore invalidate the law. And as we've just discussed, Chair, it is our view that in civil cases or in civil matters, laws can have a retrospective application, and that this retrospective application is still legal even if it may affect the property rights of those who of certain parties, and that this so this view, Chair, is supported by a legal opinion we have by advocate Badlender, and we feel that it is not inconsistent with tax laws, environmental laws, and a whole range of other regulatory interventions required from time to time by the state.
Yeah, Makoshi?
No, what is the rationale for the retrospective application? I don't want to make an assumption that I understand why we need to have that retrospective application. What's the rationale?
The rationale is that we, in crafting the amendments, we have come up with an additional tool that we would like to use in curatorships going forward, but it also very importantly allows for an additional tool in this case. And in effecting the best least cost outcome in relation to the African Bank curatorship, we will require an additional tool, and a tool that is accepted internationally and has been used extensively internationally in similar situations.
Would you be correct to say that if you don't have retrospectivity, then the bill is not going to be helpful, is that right? Because, I mean, this happened in August last year, and you're trying to address the issues. And if it doesn't apply to August last year, then a substantial part of the rationale falls away. Would that not be a crude way of saying it? I don't know what the market and legal sensitivities are now in this guy, but I mean, this is a simple politician's question.
We were sort of pretending this wasn't, but we put in the we have in the latest version, which we put forward to the committee, our proposals, we've stated clearly this bill applies to curatorships that are sure if that's retrospective or retroactive. Because there's a whole different chain. I'm not a lawyer, so enough of a lawyer to explain that. But there's a whole big debate in the senior counsel opinion about retrospectivity and retroactivity and their big differences. I should read the opinion. Their view is that they're not even sure that, because it's currently happening, but I should not be quoted on that.
Well, Advocate Jenkins is, in a nutshell, not a long thing. What's the difference between retrospective and retroactive? Presumably retroactive is something that's currently taking place, and simultaneously you're passing a law to deal with that. Retrospective is something has taken place, and then you subsequently bring it. Is that my understanding correct, a crude way of understanding?
My understanding is equally crude, if I can say that, Chairperson. The retrospective for me is the easier one. It's not changing the past, but changing the results of what happened in the past. And this is what we're dealing with here, at retrospectivity. Retroactivity means that the legislation actually applies to an event in the past and changes what happened in the past. Now, for me, it sounds very similar. I read through that case. I read through a legal opinion that makes a distinction. In the end, Chair, if I may say so, I'll stick my neck out. It's really important to make that distinction because the Constitution allows the backwards working on a piece of legislation. Unless it's criminal, then criminal law you cannot, but otherwise there are certain conditions under which a law may work retrospectively or retroactively. But the exact distinction, in the legal opinion, I think from National Treasury, they try to make the differentiation, as I said now, but when I analyze the way they make it, I can't understand why it's such a big difference between it from a country.
No, Chair. The other thing that we're whispering amongst ourselves is my question. The retrospect. I also do, Chuhe. What we were saying, we hear the retrospective.
Do you miss me?
I do.
Oh. I know when you miss me.
Can I say that? If we're saying a retrospective, how far do we go? That's the question we're asking ourselves. Do we go from since the incident? We hear that you're saying the current, it refers to the current curatorship. Fine. And this happened, when was it? Last year? August. Does it date back to August, or what does it happen, the retrospective thing?
Just simply, it's a prior situation that is currently in train. There is, they may, I will not answer for them. I think we should let them speak on that. And if you don't want to add anything about whether it's retrospective, anybody wants to switch that. This is where you need advocates. We have two, and we have a very good attorney, but...
maybe I'm going to say it more complicated than Roy did, but if the bill is passed, and the President signs it into law and it becomes law, say for instance on the 1st of June, then any curatorship that's currently underway that immediately before that date on the 31st of May, the act will apply to the amendments. So if in the meantime the curators resolve everything, then they wouldn't require the new powers. But as I think earlier explained, the bill introduced certain new powers for the curator that he can use if necessary.
What is their reply when you say this? Yeah, Chair.
I have a question here, but maybe I should start by checking my understanding on the last paragraph of your response on this retrospectively. It says, make me understand this English here. Reserve Bank has been careful not to execute the intervention plan for African Bank before the amendments to the Banks Act have been accepted into law. In this regard, the actions of the curator will not be retrospective. Well, what does that mean?
They haven't used any of the powers that we are proposing. And the reason for that is because, Chair, it's your decision whether or not you give them the powers, number one, it's not for them to use them. Secondly, they want to be very clear that Parliament agrees that they can use these powers. And thirdly, they will only use the powers after you've given them it to them. On that basis, some of the legal opinions have said, actually, this isn't retrospective.
In the letter written to the chair by the curator, Mr. Retterpoor, I hope I'm pronouncing the same name correct, he made an indication that changes won't be effected if the amendments are not obviously agreed to, and that might lead to the unfortunate situation of liquidation. I don't know where I'm sitting with my oversight mandate. I'm trying to understand how does this affect the curator's performance now. I'm not sure if there's a self-appointed spokesperson on my behalf, but the chair, amendments, how does this affect the mandate of the curator now? Because the intention is to avoid the unfortunate situation, which is liquidation. So how does this process, this waiting and obviously processing that we need to do also on our side as parliamentarians, impact on the final article? The realization of the final objective of this exercise. I just want to relate this whole thing, you know.
Yeah.
No, I think this letter as well, I actually found it to be quite profound, because the curator in terms of this is even making a very profound statement that if if no decision basically is taken, or if this legislation is not considered, he's citing that there will be a reduction in the amount available for payment to the creditors of the bank. Now, I don't know how is that going to happen, what are the factors that are going to be informing that. I'm not sure if it's in this letter that has been written by the curator. Because I think the question by them is actually very important, because we also need to understand, appreciate the agency and understand the implications of our indecision or our speedy decision-making process.
Chair, I will read directly what the curator has written, and then I will ask the curator's lawyers to respond on his behalf, because I do not want to speak for the curator. The curator has written, in the absence of the proposed changes to the aforesaid changes, the aforesaid proposal cannot, in our opinion, be implemented, and if no other proposal for the resolution of the bank is forthcoming, it will probably result in the failure of the bank and ultimately in its liquidation. I don't know if the curator's lawyers would like to speak for the curator on this.
Thank you. In the hearings yesterday, there were a couple of questions about alternatives. What I can say now is that at the moment, the only real consortium of six banks and the CIC underwritten by the SOL. In terms of that proposal, the banks and the CIC will put in up to 10 billion rands worth of new capital into the business of the bank. And because of the level of distress of the bank, I understand from the financial people who advise the curator that new capital is absolutely essential for this bank to be able to continue as a bank rather than simply to collapse and be wound up. At the moment, our view and the advice given to the curator is that the current drafting of the curatorship provisions in the Banks Act do not permit the curator to dispose of assets and liabilities of the bank into a new entity. So that, and to take a step back, the consortium says they'll put in 10 billion rand so as to start the bank off again. But they will not put 10 billion rand into African Bank Limited, the current vehicle. And there are a number of reasons for that, and one of them is the last bank failure, which was Sambo. And there are a number of members of the consortium who were involved on the Sambo transaction, and they, to this day, are dealing with liability claims in court. And that is approximately 10 years or 9 years since Sambo failed. With that experience, the holders of the cheque are saying the 10 billion is available, but it will not go into the current entity. It must go into a new entity because a new entity does not have historical liabilities, doesn't have skeletons in the closet. And the concern is if you put 10 billion into African Bank and skeletons come out of the closet, that 10 billion then doesn't go to improving the business of the bank. It goes to settling claims of creditors who we don't know about today. Because the banks, and that's why we're here, that's the most credible deal on the table now, but we need the power to transfer the assets and the liabilities into a new entity in order to give effect to that deal. If someone else comes along and says they are more than happy to take on the risk of unknown liabilities in the current African Bank entity, and they're willing to put 10 billion rand or more into that entity, then it may well be that that is the best deal, and the director will have to apply his mind and give effect to that deal. But at the moment, that deal is not on the table. So at the moment, what we're looking at is two scenarios: a new good bank and a new entity, or liquidation. And liquidation would mean that 4,700 people lose their jobs. On the current deal, all of us, or at least the four, those who are still in the bank, because there's natural attrition as we go, at the date that the transaction is implemented, those members of staff will all go to the new bank. Those jobs will be preserved in the new bank. And that's an important consideration, because that's one of the things the curator is required to consider in the exercise of his powers.
Then to come back to the thing about how much of this is necessary, how much of it should be in the Twin Peaks book. Oh, Bridget? Ah, yes, sorry. About that.
Essentially, we have put in the absolute bare minimum that we need to deliver this. We whittled it down. We have a draft resolution bill. There's a very first draft about it. And so what we've done is we've taken the absolute minimum number of clauses from that bill to amend this bill. We would have obviously have preferred to have brought the resolution bill. We will bring it to you, but we would have preferred not to have brought this bill because we would have preferred to have a full bill. But we need this bill to deliver the creation of African banks, so we've brought forward the minimum number of clauses. And Chair, there really are very few clauses. I know that some of them are quite contentious, but it is a very thin bill, actually. And I think hopefully that answers how they're related. You're basically seeing a kind of a preview of the resolution bill, because we need this bill to get the creation through.
Thank you, Chairperson. On this issue of the bill that's fairly short, and I think it's a good idea, I did have a question regarding the minister, it was the section that refers to what the minister and the registrar can do, the wide powers they have. The stable banking system of the Republic and then the public confidence in the banking sector, so they have some kind of discretion. And I wanted to get some kind of indication of what other jurisdictions do, because that is troubling to me. I think that if I can get some insights into what other jurisdictions have, and then I can maybe get a bit more comfort on it. I have got my own researcher working on it, but I know time is of the essence, so if you have anything on that, I would like to get it. Thanks, Jay.
We will send the document. I think we have a review of, there's a peer review of what other jurisdictions have done. I think we have a public version of that. In short, there's a range of some jurisdictions that give extraordinary powers. I think it was Italy that passed the bill overnight. They basically, because they have a slightly different legal system to us, they can ramble through. Some jurisdictions allow very broad discretion to the executive, depending on their constitutional system. Some jurisdictions do not allow broad discretion to the jurisdiction. We have simply put forward a proposal that we believe is constitutional in the context of our jurisdiction. And that is why we have spent so much money and so much time and effort on they are probably the most expensive senior houses in the country, to make sure that what we have proposed fits into our constitutional system. But we will certainly send you documents giving the broad range. Some jurisdictions, the minister can just reorganize everything overnight. He doesn't have, there's no reviews, there's no administration, there's no administrative justice. Some other jurisdictions, I think, it's like the Jenkins High, the administrative tribunals. It all depends on your constitutional system.
Despite these differences globally, is there like an FSB set of guidelines?
Yes, there's a set of key attributes. So these are the things that they say you and your jurisdiction must try and achieve. For me, the most important one is that there is you must try and build a system as far as possible that doesn't put any taxpayers' money at risk. Secondly, they say that what you must do is respect the hierarchy of creditors, which means that you must pay senior creditors first and then subordinated creditors second. Third one, which I think is of interest to this committee, is obviously that you should have a system that is relatively quick and painless. And I think those are the most important ones. You can talk to them. You have them in front of you.
In terms of the international comparability, the clauses that the Honourable Member mentioned are essentially how you calibrate the public interest. And the FSB, which is a group of G20s, I'll read you exactly what it says. It says the objective of an effective revision regime is to make feasible the resolution of financial institutions without severe systemic disruption and without exposing taxpayers to loss, while protecting vital economic functions through mechanisms which make it possible for shareholders and unsecured and uninsured creditors to absorb losses in a manner that respects the hierarchy of claims in liquidation.
Oh, but in respect to the specific other issue raised about the powers of the minister or the executive, is there a set of guidelines that the FSB provides in regard to that? They don't, because of the diversity of regimes.
Sorry, Chair, so it's outcomes-based. So the outcomes are to prevent severe...
Okay, Mugila, the next thing I want to ask then is, so we just to get a sense of where we are, right? What's the DA's position on this bill for now?
We will have to discuss the matter with our caucus, obviously, which we'll do tomorrow. But our position is this at the moment, is that we don't want to see the bank fail, obviously, so that's the first point. So we don't want to see the bank fail. We don't want to see taxpayers having to pick up the tab for the failure. We were and are interested in if there was another solution to the one that was proposed, i.e. the separation of the good and the bad bank. But we haven't seen anything else. We've asked several times now for it, and we've asked people that came to this committee to tell us, well, in the committee we said, what's your alternative, and we haven't seen anything. So at the moment there is only one, and that's the one we have. So if it is the only one, then the question is then how do you implement that? The legislation doesn't provide for that. Therefore, we need to do something about that. We need to make sure there's enabling legislation. But having said that, we need to see what the content then is of that legislation, because it affects everything else as well. So that's the thinking of my colleague and myself at the moment, as I said, we have not had broader consultations within our own caucus, which we need to do, but that's where we are at the moment. Thank you, Chair.
The same applies to the ANC as well. I mean, there will have to be discussions, but all right, so I just want to check something. You see, Cindy, when you bring us an amendment bill, I think you should also have the original act. Unless it's an act that runs into like thousands of pages, then we just look for the relevant sections. So I asked Alan to arrange for the Banks Act. Is that a very, how long is it? A very long act? Sorry?
The man who wrote most of it says
90 pages. All right, but we need to look at the act. So can I understand where we're going to go from here, and let's see whether we agree. The first is the second tier people, if they want to make a submission still verbal, we should arrange for that, right? Reasonably soon, so that the research teams on the parliamentary side and you as well can prepare. The Banking Council approached me yesterday. I think the representative might be here. I can't see too well from this distance, but I think she's here, and asked whether we would like a further submission. But personally, I don't know whether, you know, they have written to say they're fine, right? Is that correct? I don't know that, it was just that the member who raised the question didn't know that they had said that. I don't know what value would be added, but if the members want to have the Banking Council appear before us, that's fine, but I just want to know what would be the value. I don't know. Anyway, but over to you, Dion, and
thank you, Chairperson. I think the issue is the timing. What I wanted to know is what was the timing that we had in mind. I was going to ask that question later, but we can, if you can answer it now. I don't think there's anything wrong with getting further inputs from the you know, the Banking Council. They could always send it in writing. I mean, we can read. So I don't think we really need to have another hearing on it. You know, we can move quite quickly. I would be very interested, and I think the people would expect us to do that, is to make sure that we've collected as much information as we possibly can from as many interested people as we possibly can before we take this through the process. But bearing in mind that it needs to be gone to go fairly quickly. So long as we've satisfied ourselves that everybody that wants to say something has had the opportunity to say it, and we've thought about it, we've processed it, and then we've moved on, I think that would be quite satisfactory. Thanks, Jim.
Let me answer that question, because that influenced your inputs, right? As I understand it, we've got next week, we've got on the agenda the strat plan of an APP of staff and Treasury, and then we're looking at the Skakane report the day after. Now, maybe I should say something on the latter in a moment, but so we don't have another sitting. When we come back, the first 3 days or 4 days, we're away on the study tour. But as I understand it, am I correct, the whole of the next week is a committee week. Is that right? So, the whole of the week after we come back, I think the first 2 weeks are committee weeks, right? So the idea was we'll finish the Banks Bill in the second week. We can have sittings all day, actually. So on the Tuesday of the second week of the second quarter, then we sit from 10 to 5, Wednesday 10 to 5. And then finish the bill. So by the Thursday, it will be finished. Now, in order to facilitate Parliament and also National Treasury's work, because National Treasury has to reply to what they said, right, their second line, I think that we should see if we can't slide in for 20 minutes, we said, to half an hour maximum, the second, clear creditors, next week, one of the days, maybe the Wednesday. Secondly, as far as the Banking Council goes, I was going to suggest that also. They can write to us, okay, if you want to pursue further. So basically, that's the timeline. So, Makosi,
yes. No,
sir.
I think I'm partially covered.
Try to be a bit cautious as to how we treat stakeholders. You know, we have agreed that the other stakeholder should present. Now we are saying this other one there, because now we have set a precedent as a committee. And I can tell you the chances are we might even get more responses or requests. So we need to be clear, why are we saying they can't present? If we have allowed the first group to present. So I'm saying we need to bite the bullet. If we allow them to present, there must be compelling reasons why we are not allowing the other groups not to do the second, to have a second eye on this process, you know. So that's what we say, since we have agreed that they must come and present, my advice to the committee is that we should allow them also. And I pray that we don't have more requests of presentation. That's my advice to the committee.
Chair, is the first time that I hear that these are desperate.
Yeah, there's no need to pray, because there's no fear. We shouldn't fear civil society. I mean, we have parliament. I mean, this is the parliament of the people. So firstly, as I've said before, personally, I don't have a problem with people coming even at the last minute if they bring valuable insights. But they're not going to hold the processes back as long as the deadline is met. The second thing to say is, as I understood it, there was a specific request by the second tier creditors with a direct vested interest. It is possible, and I hope it won't happen, they could go to court. So they requested it, and as I said, in a previous era, I would have said yes, but yesterday I thought I should seek consensus on it, and it seems both the majority parties, both the big parties, agree. On the issue of the Banking Council, they didn't ask to make a submission. What actually happened is a member asked, why is the Banking Council not saying anything, to which the reply was written that they had to stay in support of them. Then it happened that a lady from Banking Council, she said, do you want us to make a submission? We could. Right. So, you know, it's not a big deal. They can be given 20 minutes if they want to. But it's a different category. It's a very clear set of guidelines. In other words, the way it came about at the Banking Council is being considered is very different. But it's right. If they want to come for 20 minutes, it won't kill us. Sally?
Chair, I don't know whether I've said it before. If I've said it before, please forgive me. I forget a lot. You know, when we engage sectors, I believe in the principle of having an amicable solution and agreeing in principle on what you want to adopt as the law. And it becomes fair enough if you allow people to make opinions. But there is nothing wrong if you are flexible enough to also allow yourself to be pursued if there are valid reasons for re-engagement. Because the advantage of re-engagement is to give one another clarity in terms of where you stand. So that when we adopt the law, even if you did not agree with us, but you contend with the reasons that informed us when we took that particular decision. So there would have been a fair platform for engagement. And I believe there's no any other platform like this one, the legislature, because that's where we can bring anybody to engage in an event there was no such engagement that took place between those who propose piece of legislation and those who want to make input or who are affected by it. So I would suggest that we avoid a situation where we are rigid and say, when we called you once, that's it, go and you made a presentation. If there is a particular grey area that needs further engagement, you should allow ourselves to be opened to that. So that when somebody decides to take us to task, for instance, people believe, let me put it this way, lawyers always have a different opinion. When you're making the law, there will be those that say this is unconstitutional. Others will say it's constitutional. It's only the constitutional court that can test whether that is correct or not. We can listen to all of them. We can get five different opinions from the same lawyers who went to attend the same law school. They will give you different interpretations in the same room. But the final arbiter in terms of their views will be the constitutional court it found that a decision that has been taken, and I think here Advocate Jenkins will agree with me. I was listening to you attentively when you were talking about retrospectivity and retroactivity. It was very interesting how people viewed it, because everybody will view a discussion with an advantage to their own cause, right? So in this context, if there is a specific area that wants further engagement, I would pledge that we allow it to close this matter, so that when we come to, because at some point people will have to contend with the decisions that we take, but at no point should people raise an issue that says we were not given adequate opportunity to raise our arguments to make them understand where we come from. That one will be a limitation. But where we say, but we engaged over and over again, you could not give us any different facts based on what we believe. And looking into the statutes themselves that informed our decision, then we will have no other. There is administrative justice in an event that you delay your argument to a point that it can't convince us, otherwise there's administrative justice. You'll have no option but to take that path where the matter will be laid to rest. So I agree with all of you. Let's be flexible, and I think in this context you have been flexible enough to allow that flow of engagement, so that we can try to pursue one another to finance. But at the end of the day, a decision must be taken, given the fact of the limitations of funds. We cannot have prolonged meetings and all that, and so on. We'll have a different approach. We will actually, in my opinion, use the leadership to guide us in terms of mostly how we'll proceed, so that it doesn't only stay with us. Because here, if you can say how we want you to approach it, we'll have different opinions. I will not want late meetings. Somebody else will want early meetings, Saturday meetings, and so on. So we'll leave it to you and the leadership, the management committee, to always guide us in terms of how we will proceed. But I will take written submissions. You know, I would even prefer video conferencing where we don't have to have people coming all the way to from prison. Yeah.
100%, Sandy, I agree with you, right? It's just that something seems to happen in Parliament in the last term, where there seems to be like this idea that public hearings are like this conveyor belt system. So let me just report to you. I spoke to Cedric Frolic yesterday, he was the House Chair responsible for chairs. And I said, look, I'm a bit concerned about this. He said, very good. Today we are meeting now, here, in this hall. He said, look, I'll give you a few minutes. I asked for it. And I wanted to speak about, as I described to you, three bills that we processed, some of the committees. And in 2004, there was an agreement that is how Parliament will operate. And then Jeff Deutsch moved on and the thing got lapsed. So we're going to... Interestingly, Cedric Frolic's been mandated by the Speaker, he tells me, to have this new public participation model. And one aspect of it is how to constantly engage with civil society. So Parliament is rooted in the people. It's not seen as distant because, you know, it's a classic thing I keep saying. It's stunning that this committee received only 8 submissions on the budget. When, you know, like years ago, you would have like this hall full. I remember coming here once. There wasn't space. So Parliament needs to become more rooted in the people. And we shouldn't fear civil society or any stakeholders. It's a confident Parliament. The majority party has got an overwhelming majority in any case. But we must hear the people. So I think, Tandy, you and I are 100% on the same thing. Let the House Chair dictate. Let it become a norm. Not some committees doing it and some not. But one thing is clear. Parliament decides. So we're not going to have endless discussions. And we set our timeline. So I think, Banking Council, you've heard it. I think I'm ruling. You want to write to us, it's fine. You want to appear for 20 minutes before us, fine. We will negotiate a date with you. The Banks Act will be given to people shortly. I'd like to suggest the following process, right? Bridget, firstly, when we come back on the second Tuesday of the second quarter, Advocate Jenkins will go through the legal issues. Bridget will deal with, you know, summarizing where you are from Parliament. Then we'll hear from Treasury, the very next day if possible. We will come with our political positions, and then we will enter the formal process of the bill, which means then that we are going to close by clause. If we can, next Wednesday, we ask both the Banking Council. is the first Tuesday we come back. So unless I'm wrong, if we sit for the Tuesday, the second Tuesday of the second quarter, from 10 to 5, or so say 10 to 4, and we sit on the Wednesday, I think we can vote on the Friday or the Tuesday after. Because this bill, we can't keep the African bank and the curator and all endlessly. They need to know. And I think today's clarity on positions has helped a lot, actually. And I really want to thank the members also for participating. Because yesterday I was feeling like we're not getting to grips with the issues. But today I'm very encouraged by the progress. So I think we can deal with this bill by finish all the stuff by the third. But even the third, we can sit on the Thursday even, if the House is not sitting. So by the Thursday afternoon of the second week, of the second quarter, we would like to finish this bill.
Yeah.
Unless something unforeseen happens. Then, Sorry? What did she say? Unless I die. I have no intention of dying till I'm 101. No intention whatsoever. I love that. You're not dying, dying. That's wonderful. Can I also raise something else? Given where we are, and these people are obviously monitoring us, right? Unless we fool hardly not to. Either they're watching the TV screen if it's being cast, or they got some spy here or whatever. I don't know. Somebody's reporting. So presumably they know what you've said. It just seems to me, unless members disagree, that given where we are, and given that we're in constituency, nothing stops you, you know, based on what you've already got the initial fields of talking to them and trying to bridge the gap. I think you've gone some way, in my view. If you can go even further before we come. But once we come back, then we take over the process, right? So we will have a small subcommittee if we have to, try to knock our heads together where we can, the way Tony says it, and if we can't, then Parliament must decide. Then the next thing to say is, yeah, that's it for my side. Is anything else, Bez, or anything? No. Okay. So we finished, and the ANC comrades remained behind for about 20 minutes.